Hey Joe, I like your show. I tell everybody that's my shit. And if you got a long ride and you like getting high, maybe go and take another hit. We gonna laugh out loud, that's what it's about. Nobody ain't safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause the motherfucker's 6'4". Hey Joe, it's time to start the show. Up, up and away we go. Mic check and I like your flow. Everybody, here's Joe.
Here we are, another episode of the Joe Prano Podcast. I'm very excited for my guest today, a good friend of mine, the director of the new documentary, The Mole Man.
It's just Mole Man.
Just Mole Man.
Mole Man.
See, this is like the Eagles thing. Did you ever read the Steve Martin book?
The Eagles.
Versus Eagles, yeah. He's like, there's a great, in the Steve Martin book, he talks about meeting whichever guy from the Eagles, and he's like, so you're going to be the Eagles? He's like, no, just Eagles. He's like, the Eagles, right? He's like, no, just Eagles. He's like, but I think you should be the Eagles. He's we're going Eagles.
It was called The Mole Man, and then that was a producer change. Not my idea. But they were like, well, we fought about the title for a long time because people were like, you know, really doesn't say anything about Ron. I'm like, yeah, but if I'm scrolling through Netflix and I see Mole Man, I'm interested.
Yeah.
If I see like The Struggles of Ron Heist or some other like long title, boring.
So
I don't want that. So the compromise was, well, instead of calling it The Mole Man, let's just call it Mole Man. I'm like, fine.
Sure. That's easy.
Great.
Many people who have heard various Joe Prano podcasts, Dirty Sports, Kooks of Comedy, a lot of people know your name. We've worked together on a lot of things, but I want to start with Mole Man because this has been your project for the last how many years? When did it officially start?
50 years ago. Yeah. I started. I met him in 2009.
And you were working on?
I was working on American Pickers, the History Channel show. It was the first season, and the production company took ads out in like local penny savers to get people to be on the show. No one knew who they were. So his cousin, who's in the movie, said, you know, you got to come out and see this guy's house. He's got a ton of stuff. They'll definitely want to buy some of it. And you've never seen anything like this. So the night
and American Pickers, so it's like the show comes out and potentially buys things from like hoarders.
Yeah. Yeah. They are two guys. One's kind of the handsome negotiator guy, and the other one's a short, chubby, funny guy.
Good cop, bad cop.
Good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
So, and they just go around the country, and it is what they actually do.
Yeah.
You know, before that, they would just find what they call barn finds, like stuff that is unseen by anyone but the owner, and sometimes the owner for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So they'll just go look at all people's stuff, and they know what's valuable and what's not. And they'll say, you know, I'll give you this much for this. And
you were, remind me, what was your role on it?
I was the director on that first season. And on a reality show like that, it's kind of, you know, that was a documentary show. It's very similar to any other documentary directing. But then there are a couple like scenes in the middle where you have to say, you have to direct a little bit more to kind of tie the story together and put a bow on it for a TV audience.
Yeah. The not reality of reality TV. Somebody has to make it actually interesting.
Yeah. But on that show, those guys, to their credit, they were actually buying the stuff. It was their money. Some other shows I worked on where they buy and sell things, not only is it not their money, but they're not even buying it or selling it. And everything is fake. So
can you tell us what show? Or you have a non-disclosure agreement? People are dying from some of these shows just recently, so maybe you're free from...
I won't name it directly, but I don't have any sort of agreement.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of stuff on Pawn Stars is not
being not bought happening. Or sold.
But I don't think people even care.
Right.
People don't give a shit. They just want to hear the story about the item, you know, play along with the negotiation thing and whatever.
Yeah.
It's like cigarettes, you know? people know they're going to kill him, but they smoke him anyway because they enjoy it.
So when you're doing Mole Man, or sorry, when you're doing the show, you meet Ron, who just set the scene for what happens when you get there.
Well, the night before, I used to Google everyone just to see if they had any online presence. I like to know what I'm getting into. And we were walking in cold to all this stuff. So I Google him, and his cousin had posted videos of the inside of his place. And immediately I was like, I saw him on camera. I thought he was probably autistic, having, you know, I have zero medical training, but it was pretty obvious.
But I've seen Rain Man.
I did.
And I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night.
Exactly. Yeah. The previous three nights I stayed at Holiday Inn Express, so I was feeling good about my diagnosis. And that morning I came down and I was like, holy shit, what we're about to see is crazy. This is like once in a lifetime thing.
So you knew before you actually
got there. I kind of prepped the whole crew. I was like, you know, he's got autism. He may not like to be touched. He may have certain sensitivities. So just be aware of that. But it's going
to
be worth it.
If you need to distract him, throw some toothpicks on the floor.
Yeah. Ask him to count some cards.
Yeah.
And then we showed up that day, and his cousin was there, and he was just being his usual reclusive self. But once he figured out that those guys wanted to talk about his stuff and wanted to talk about music from the 50s and 60s, he was all about it, you know. And he's a funny person. He does not get sarcasm, but he likes to joke around. He loves making fat jokes to people. That's one of his favorite things to do. He's big in fat shaming.
So when you were there,
when I showed up that morning, I was like, this is nothing, you know, this is it. Like, as someone who does documentaries or any kind of filmmaking, you're always kind of have your eye open for something that's untouched, untold, a story that is unlike any other that you've ever heard before. So the second I showed up, the second I saw what he was doing, I was like, this is 100% something that needs to be, that I'm going to come back here and I'm going to follow this up.
Right, so that, in that moment, you knew this is bigger than American Pickers.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And describe, obviously, anybody who ends up seeing your movie, which is making the rounds at festivals now and will be on the Sundance Channel.
It's going to be on their streaming service called Sundance Now.
Great. Even better. Who has cable anymore?
In January. Yeah. For all you cord cutters out there.
Yeah.
It's a subscription service, but you can get a free trial. So in January, just sign up for a week, watch the movie, and then cancel it. Or no, don't do that. you can, but you can sign up and watch it online. It'll be released worldwide.
So to sort of tease people, give the best description of what you found when you got there.
When you go up there, just his mom lives in the front house, and it's like a red brick, normal mid-century, you know, like ranch style home.
In rural Pennsylvania.
Rural Pennsylvania. Yeah, there's like, you know, three other houses on the road. It's a large property. It's an acreage. And then on the side of the garage, you can kind of see this, all this stuff spilling out. It looks like a cross between a gigantic art installation and a haunted house. And to enter his place, you have to go into a narrow tunnel. And once you get in there, there's no light. It's completely dark. Everything in the tunnel is made of things he's collected over the years. And it's packed in there like a Jenga game. And you quickly lose your sense of direction, how far you are, what elevation you're at, if you're underground or above ground. And then that tunnel goes back for, I want to say, like 100 to 150 feet before you actually hit a structure. And then at that point, all you see is a door. You're still in sort of this tunnel structure.
150 feet of just garbage tunnel.
Garbage tunnel, basically. Yeah. I mean,
it's not trash, but it's,
it's treasures to him.
Yeah.
But it is, it's crazy. Yeah.
And then there's an actual multi-room, multi-building structure.
So he's got, once you get back into there, he's got 26 buildings that he's built all by hand and all from materials he's found at abandoned homes throughout Western Pennsylvania. So, you know, it's like your cousin that has the pink door on the El Camino with the brown hood.
And, right.
You know, like, it's that times a million. Right.
Do you have an estimate on like what the square footage of that kind of thing would be?
It's built over, I want to say it's like 3 acres.
Jeez.
You know, there's a scene in the movie when a drone flies over the entire property. And
yeah.
It's like it just keeps going and going and going and going.
That's what I was going to say. You do a great job in the film, and thank God for drone technology that you didn't have to get a helicopter for your documentary, because I don't think there is a way to show the actual size of this thing without being from above.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like when the way you sort of show it just with a handheld camera, it's a maze. It's essentially like a haunted house.
Until I saw that drone footage, I didn't know how big it was. I had no idea, because you can't.
And it's sort of in the woods, a lot of tree coverage.
Yeah.
And now, when you say he built it with just materials that he found at abandoned homes, in the film, you show him getting on a motorcycle and carrying like tons of things. Like at one point, I think he has a door on the back of it, and he's like on a little, not a big motorcycle.
No,
there's no sidecar. It's like a
maybe. I forget what the model is, but it's like 150 cc's, and he's carried a cast iron bathtub on the back of that thing
by himself.
Yeah, by himself. Yeah.
So, and then also he's put up concrete walls.
They're block walls.
Block walls.
Right. So he'll put up like a 4x8 piece of plywood down on the back of his motorcycle, and then strap block. Like, he carries block on that, and he carries all kinds of building materials on that. He's like a physics savant, like balancing and anything like that. And that leads into how he builds his walls, which is...
I have a hard time riding my bike with like a bag with lunch on one handlebar.
Yeah.
Because I'm just like, oh, I'm off.
No,
I'm going down.
It is difficult, but he does a lot more than that. I don't understand how he, you know, there's that moment if you put something on your bike and then you have to balance.
Yeah.
Like, you have a cast iron bathtub on the back of your bike.
Yeah,
like,
how do you not get the wobbles?
If you are on a motorcycle and you have a rider on the back of your bike that is 20 more pounds than you, it's makes things pretty difficult.
Yeah.
So I don't often put people on the back of my motorcycle that weigh more than me.
But one time.
One time. Yeah.
What's amazing about that and the autism thing is also, you know, a big part of your film, and sort of he's in rural Pennsylvania, so it's not even the sort of place where they would even diagnose this kind of thing. Like, he's just a weird guy who's collecting stuff and building something in his mom's yard.
When he was a kid, and back at that time,
and he's how old?
He is 67, in better shape than you or I.
Yeah.
But when he was a kid, this was the 1950s, they didn't know what autism was. They just said, your son is retarded. He's slightly retarded.
Mm-hmm.
That's the word they used back then, hard R.
Right.
So they could have sent him to an institution, but they kept him home. And they knew he loved building things, so they just encouraged that. And they ended up with a 26 building compound in their backyard, and he's still going.
When I watch him and I watch him talk and I watch the way he's built this structure, and I watch, there's one scene in it where he asks you to even try to sort of knock the wall down.
Yeah.
And because there's no mortar between these blocks.
Yeah, no mortar, no nails.
No mortar and no nails in a 26 building structure that he's made out of materials he's found in abandoned homes.
Yeah.
I like, that's great. I need a nail to, you know, put the house of cards together.
Yeah. It is, it's insane. And people are always like, aren't you worried about it falling on you or things collapsing in? And it's so incredible. It's also over, you know, really overbuilt. And he takes his time with stuff. He's not on any tight schedule.
Right.
He's been doing this for over 50 years. So, you know, he uses weight and pressure and opposing forces to do everything. And, you know, one thing is built on another that's built on another that's built on another. It's solid. It's not going anywhere.
What it makes me think about when I watch him talk and I watch, you know, you try to sort of kick into the wall and you see exactly how sturdy this is they people talk about, you know, we only use 10% of our brain and stuff like that. It's almost like the autism or his condition, whatever it is like he's using more of his brain than we are. And maybe the thing, again, I'm not a scientist, I know nothing about it, but it almost seems like the reason we only use 10% of our brain is because then you start losing function in being able to socialize, being able to talk to people, having like the ability to do whatever, because he's certainly working on a higher level with like you said, physics, with, you know, the balancing of everything than I could possibly imagine doing, and that most people really could even conceptualize.
Yeah. The interesting thing I learned during the course of the film is people with autism have these really defined hyper interests, and I forget the word that describes it. And if I try to pronounce it, I'll just embarrass myself. But so they find one thing and they just dive in super deep because that gives them comfort. Right. And for Ron, I think it's his connection to the rest of the world, like building and music are the two things that he understands. So he understands them better than anything because he doesn't get sarcasm. He doesn't really understand, you know, a romantic relationship like someone without autism.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't. He's not into sports. He's not into politics. He's not into movies. That social piece that's so important to a lot of people, to most of us, is missing.
Yeah.
That need for social connection just doesn't exist the way, I mean, I don't fully understand it, but in the way that we need likes on Instagram or Facebook or approval from others, he doesn't get that. And also, and this is kind of sidebarring, one of the things that I set out when I was initially making the movie was thinking about autism in a different way. There is a camp out there that wants to think about autism like a disease and it's something you can cure. Or is it just another way of being? And thinking about it, maybe this is some sort of evolution of, you know, I have no idea.
Right, of the brain.
Of the brain,
yeah.
In some way. But that's me just in an edit room being like getting too caught up in it.
So when did the process of actually making the film start for you? After obviously you meet him, American Pickers, I'm going to come back.
And then I went back, visited him, shot a few things, and didn't really see this as a feature. You know, he was a curiosity. It's like a 15, 20 minutes of screen time. And there was no feature story there, and I knew that if I tried to build what I had into a feature story, it wasn't going to be enough to hold the attention. You know, you need a strong narrative, and it just didn't present itself to me initially. And then you actually reached out to me and sent me the thing.
Oh, my God. That's right. I didn't even think about that till right now.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Sent me the thing with Tongle.
Right.
Where they were doing running a documentary competition, this website that essentially crowdsources creative. They get a brief from an ad agency and just share the brief with the world and then have people pitch in on that. Promotion, they partnered with a producer of documentaries, put a pitch out for the next great documentary, and you had submitted some stuff. You'd been working on a thing with Alan Weisbecker.
Yeah, the only thing that's probably been worked on longer than Mole Man, although I haven't really worked on it, but it's out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you said, hey, you know, you wanted me to submit that through my company because you were too close to the company. Yeah. And said, you know.
And also, I have no documentary experience whatsoever. I just have a bunch of footage. So if you're interested,
yeah,
we can do this.
And you'd said, hey, they're doing this promotion. I think you sent it to me and Ed David.
Yeah.
Who's now since gone on to become a super successful director of photography.
Oh, really?
I didn't know David?
That. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I know.
Do you know, have you heard of the, you should have him on the podcast.
Oh, I can't wait.
Did you, the Dove Real Beauty sketches, do you remember that?
Yeah.
He shot that.
Yep.
He shot another thing that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes.
Wow.
This Philips Breathless campaign. So.
Can't wait to have Ed on.
Yeah.
So then how long ago was that you started the process?
That was 2013.
So it's
2013 or 2014, if I remember correctly.
So we're around 5 years.
Yeah. Four or five years.
Now when the process starts, they like your pitch, you know, you start getting some ability to make, you know, go out and acquire more footage. What, besides obviously Ron's personality and sort of the difficulties with that, what was the hardest part about doing this film? Because it seems like it's been a long time, and it certainly seems like it's been, you know, I mean, documentaries don't seem like they're easy breezy, but
yeah. You set out, so I worked with Tongal, obviously, and then White Horse Pictures. And initially, the time was difficult. There are a lot of things that are hard about it. getting his family on board, I thought, was going to be really difficult. And I kind of pitched everything before I'd fully gotten his family on board with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in a spot where I...
You've got to now reverse produce?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I find myself in quite a bit. And, you know... you got to kind of fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
Just in life, I think. I'll run into that a lot. I mean, too much. I like to stress myself out.
Yeah.
So, Tongal was like ready to move forward with everything, and I still had to talk to his brother and sister, and they were cool with it. You know, mm-hmm. ultimately, the film is made to help him and his family. The other thing was time. Time was my enemy. Initially, the hope was that we could get the film made in 6 months, which I did get a cut done in 6 months, but it was pretty clear that there was more still had to happen with the story in order to get a full film. And now what that was going to be was up in the air. You know, the film, I talked about it, but the film really became a feature story while... right around the same time you sent me that thing for the competition, his father passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So now his mom's 90. He's never lived alone. She's not going to live forever.
Right.
So the story becomes
what happens to Ron. What happens to this, his life's work, which is, he's truly more than a lot of people, his life's work.
Yeah.
Up one single project that he's been working on for 50 years.
Yeah. So I think actually the toughest part.
So nice job reverse producing into that.
Yeah, exactly.
Whack his dad and like now we got a feature.
Ooh. The toughest part was ending the film, I think, and just figuring out when is this story actually done? Because without his mom, his mom passing away and something happening with the house would have mm-hmm. been the obvious end to the film. But she's 94 now, and she's still good. And, you know, obviously I would love for her to live forever and for her and Ron to be happy forever. So just figuring that piece out, you know, there were a lot of stressful things along the way, but from a filmmaking perspective, it's hard to end a story that doesn't end.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
especially in a documentary, as opposed to, you know, when you're doing a narrative, you write your ending and it's over. But I even think in that tone, some of the best things, The Sopranos comes to mind, because I just started rewatching The Sopranos again, but it's sort of a moment in time. it starts with a minor event and it ends like how it ends, you know, not to spoil the not ending for anybody, but like it's just a carved out block of time.
Yeah.
And to me, that's always more interesting than here's the origin story and here's the character dying.
Right.
So I watched an early cut of your film. I watched the one I saw was probably close to 2 years ago now. So you've got who knows what's coming, but I remember the two sort of themes that run through it are, you know, sort of this diagnosis of Ron because it has never happened, and just sort of having that aspect of like what is actually his deal and like let's talk about it and let's like put it out there, and then also what's going to happen when, you know, his mom passes away. And obviously, like you said, his mom's still alive and doing well, but
spoiler alert,
right?
I gave the spoiler alert. Right. The mom's still alive,
but yeah. Like was there in doing the film, was there answers for Ron's family? Like, obviously, forget the viewer, but like, did it help them to find a place with Ron and his project that everybody's sort of like, oh yeah, now we've got that.
As in, did it help them to understand Ron better?
To help them understand it, was it something that they were even thinking about? Like, what happens to Ron after?
Yeah, they were thinking about it. Me doing the film forced them to make some decisions, to think about it a little bit more, and also help them understand Ron. You know, Ron was never diagnosed with autism. The family was suspicious that he may have it, but never actually gave him a test. So during the course of the film, in order to get aid, you have to have a diagnosis of autism to get help from the state. So that happened during the film, and his brother and sister received the diagnosis, were able to talk to the doctor about what autism is, and because of that, have a greater understanding of who Ron is. You know, for his brother, he was constantly talking to Ron about, like, what are we going to do? Like, we have to make preparations for when mom passes away. Why can't you start to clean this stuff up? Like, here are our goals for you. You need to clean this up. We need to have this done. And one of the core features of autism is an inability to think about the future. Like, this moment is where, you know, they live. They're like the ultimate party animal.
Right.
You
know?
There is no tomorrow, man. Yeah. There's just right now. But truthfully, it's like, why would anything be... Nothing is going to be different from this moment we're in right now. I'm never going to have to deal with anything different. Like, they just think very concrete. There's not a lot of abstract future thinking, future planning. So if someone has autism, don't let them be your financial planner.
Right. is there
that's probably not true.
Yeah,
whatever. I'm just
well, you know, I forget what about autism I was watching where they actually brought money into it, which was that the content, like especially dollars, you know, everything's a cent is 100, so it's like it's an easy math problem. It's not like minutes to seconds, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's an easy math problem, and a lot of autistics are very gifted in math and understand that at like can do super math, but then the concept of finances is like, what's a car cost, like $1 million? And you're like, no. And but like putting value on things, and so there is that. That's like one of the places where I've heard there is this divide. Like, it is just, money's just a number.
Right.
But they can't do the number.
Why this would be worth $20 or why X is worth $1.
Right.
You know, just doesn't, linking those things up doesn't.
In the popular.
Make a lot of sense.
In the popular sort of autism stories, the Rain Mans and like the different things, there's always the moment where something is taken away and the autism becomes like dangerous, you know? Gotta watch Wapner. Like, if we don't watch Wapner, you know, there's gonna be a meltdown. Is that something at all that you saw in Ron in talking about hey, this might have to go at some point. Like, you might not, we might have to take all this down.
Again, it wasn't an issue talking about it or thinking about it because it wasn't happening.
Right.
You know, if you talked about Rain Man missing Wapner,
right,
he would just tell you, no, I have to see Judge Wapner. We just got to be there at 3 o'clock. Like, it's not an option. Like, we're not missing Wapner, obviously. That's my routine. That's what I do. We're going to see Wapner. Now, there were times where his brothers and sisters told me about him, you know, not getting something he wanted or having to do something else, and that would lead to a meltdown. But Ron's life is constructed around his schedule, his needs. You know, he eats at the same time every day. He eats the same thing every day. He goes to bed at the same time every day. He has no one's controlling his schedule except for Ron. If I would show up late, he'd be upset with me. You know, if I said I was going to be there at like 2 o'clock, that's why I had a hard time ever, you know, things change. I'm kind of doing this in my free time a lot of times. So if I had a job come up and I was supposed to go out there and I had to change that date, that did not go over well, especially if it was 2 or 3 days before I was supposed to go.
And how? What is his reaction? He's yelling at you? He doesn't yell.
He just shuts down. Just gets real quiet.
And then would that manifest itself the next time you did show up? Would he be a little bit more?
He'd get over it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other part of the film that I find fascinating is he lives in this portion of Pennsylvania where, and you'll have to tell me, but obviously it was a flourishing area at one point, like a lot of Pennsylvania, and then sort of, you know, industry died, and there's tons of these sort of abandoned homes, like more than a lot of places, there's homes for him to go kind of pillage their stuff.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite parts is that he always takes the plunger.
Yeah.
Because everybody always leaves their plunger behind. You don't pack it to move.
Yeah.
And does he write the date, like, and the place on these things when he brings them back?
Date, the place, what the weather was like that day.
He's got a log.
He'll draw. Well, that's on the plunger.
That's on just the plunger.
Yeah. Yeah. So
are they all kept in one location?
He's got them all over the place. Okay. I mean, there's a bunch in one room.
Yeah.
But and he's got stashes of them everywhere. I think he's got 400 or 500 plungers.
There's no plumbing in the place, or is there?
There's no plumbing. No. So not in his place. He still uses his mom's house to bathe.
He's got to go. He's got to come from acres away through a structure to go to the bathroom.
He takes it. Well, he will just use nature.
Right. He's in the woods.
Yeah. He does come up to the house to eat every day, though. Mm-hmm. So I think he, and then takes a bath every other day.
It's essentially the world's biggest tree fort.
Yeah. If you were 12 years old forever,
yeah,
you might have something like that. He's Peter Pan.
Now, he does have, but he does go out on this motorcycle and he does go in search of these things. So is he mapping his way to places? I'm assuming he doesn't have an iPhone. He's not GPSing. Or is he just like getting on a motorcycle and just driving in a general area?
He knows the area really well. And he, you know, most of Western Pennsylvania, he's been on almost every road. In fact, at one point I stayed in an Airbnb like 45 minutes away from him near a lake in a cabin. And he's like, turn left on this road, right on this road. He's like, is the grass overgrown a little bit? Is it red? Is there a building on the left? I'm like, this guy has been, you know, it was so far away from his house, but he's been there and he's driven by it.
Wow.
And because people didn't stay there every night, he had his eye on that place.
Yeah. Because it's an Airbnb.
Airbnb. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And the grass got overgrown a little bit. It was on his list of places.
Strange people coming and going. They might be taking his stuff.
Yeah.
So that brings me to the other thing, which is there's this sort of fantasy structure that's talked about in the film. This Shangri-La, where some super rich person has abandoned all of these vintage cars and motorcycles and whatever, and he's trying to find his way back there because this is his great This would be his great treasure to go back there. He found it once before. Now, the thing about when I watch it and when I've talked to you about it, there's sort of two opposing things that I'm left with. One, if you can remember where random Airbnbs on lakes are 45 miles away, how does he not exactly know where this place is? And the other one is everything about his personality just doesn't say to me, oh, he's a liar. Like he's just, he has the ability to make up this fantastic tale
right.
about a place. So you guys actually go looking for this place. I haven't seen a cut of this where this place is discovered. So what was that like?
Well, there's been more added to the film.
Right. I know. I'm so sure.
You've seen it last.
And I assumed that was, you know, because that there certainly wasn't an answer one way or the other in the last cut I saw. But what was it like sort of following this guy's tale of
So as far
wonder?
As whether it exists or not, and, you know, he's able to see all these roads and everything, he does have that ability. But he also, in translating from a map to real life, he's not great with that. So he's been pointing out a spot on a map to everyone, and we all think that's where it is, when in reality, there could, you know, he's better with landmarks and telling directions by, like, left here, right here, left here. Okay, here's the tree with the broken branch hanging off of it. I know I make a right here. But then remembering what direction he's headed and putting that on a map is not something he's great with. Taking that journey and going back there. I mean, it's what he talks about is a 50-room mansion, 10 classic cars inside. The whole thing is furnished. And honestly, places like that exist in Pennsylvania. Maybe not with 10 classic cars, but I've certainly seen a few cars. I've seen other motorcycles. You know, people move away. They don't have a lot of family or they don't have a lot of kids. And roads get overgrown or someone far away on the property, they die. And it was never on a map or a grid. Yeah. It was built before then. And it gets overgrown. It's completely plausible and possible. And you want to believe it. That's the other thing. And another feature of autism is that they don't make shit up.
Right.
You know? Just like we were talking about, you can't think abstractly. Like, to give the detail that he's given just seems so impossible.
Right.
And he shows a bunch of stuff from the house that he has in his basement. And it's all from a certain time period. It all fits. Mm-hmm. He's taken license plates off the cars that are up there.
Well, I remember when you sort of told me about this before I'd seen any thing except maybe like a teaser of the film, and then just watching him talk, I was like, oh, I believe him. Like, this guy, he just doesn't seem like he's got, like, the way he describes everything so perfectly. There's the one scene, probably my favorite thing in the whole film, is where he's talking about the room you crawl through with balls. There's a room of balls that you will pass through.
Yeah.
And then he just starts listing balls.
Yeah.
And he knows, like, tennis balls, baseballs, bocce balls, like, yeah, bowling balls, everything. Every time you think, well, that's just about it for balls, he's like, basketballs.
Mush balls,
croquet balls. You're like, okay. And he's, more balls. I'm like, geez, I didn't even realize that there were this many types of balls.
Yeah. You know, when that happened, you remember that scene in Best in Show where he's listing off all the different kinds of nuts?
Yeah.
So when he told me there's 400 balls in the fourth floor, I was like, immediately, like, I know he's going to know every single kind of ball that's up there. So I asked that question. I was like, so happy because I love that part of Best in Show. And Ron did the exact same
thing. It's almost like, and it reminded me a lot of Forrest Gump with the shrimp.
Yeah.
You just keep cutting away. Same cuts thing. To things. Yeah. They're still working on a different place. Coconut fried shrimp, rainbow shrimp. Yeah, it's Boiled fantastic. Shrimp. Yeah. So people will be able to watch this on Sundance streaming.
Yep.
And how has the festival scene been? How's it been like traveling around showing this to people in theaters?
It's great. It's a great ego boost. I think that it's great meeting other filmmakers and talking to other people that have been through similar struggles and just being around a group of people that really appreciates the work that goes into filmmaking, because to the general public, they see, it's an hour and a half experience and most of them don't think about what goes into it. I've definitely met some people that are cooler than others.
Yeah.
But I've really enjoyed all the festivals and it's been the first experience for me. I could see how you could get jaded on it just like anything else, but to me it's like that's the victory lap, you know?
Yeah.
And
people can ask you stand up at the front of the theater,
yeah,
applause, questions,
talk about your movie.
Yeah.
Everyone loves it. Everyone enjoys meeting you. I learn things from sitting in screenings, not from the Q&A because everyone's happy then, but you know, you can feel when people are ready or like done with the scene or ready to move. It's really mm-hmm. helpful to watch your movie with a live audience. Because when scenes are dragging, you know, you were at that one screening in LA before it was released. And, you know, there were things I learned from that where it's like, oh, this scene's too long. People are starting to shift around in their seat. They're waiting for the next thing to happen.
And is that do you sit in the back so you can kind of see the physical?
Yeah. It's weird though. You almost feel the energy of the room.
Yeah.
When someone's done with something.
Tell me about it. I mean,
exactly. Comedy's the same thing. It's
about
a little more.
About 20 minutes in, people start going, is this guy?
Yeah.
He's not the headliner, right?
But it is, it's weird how you can just get the vibe. You know, when everyone's silent and sitting completely still, they're plugged in. But, you know, it goes the same for any music, being a musician, being a comedian, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
I think comedy, it's much more palpable when the room is not into it.
Yeah. Well, that you know, it's funny because when I watched your film in a screening room, there is a lot of it that's really funny. There is a lot, like, he's a funny guy. He's an interesting guy. But then there's also, you know, audience is like, am I supposed to be laughing? Am I not supposed to be laughing? Is this guy like sick? Is it bad that I'm laughing? But all of that stuff, it kind of like all wraps itself up. And then people just, the energy of, oh, okay. There was distinct moments when I watch it where people are all laughing together at this, you know, at a documentary about a guy who built a thing in his backyard who's autistic.
Yeah.
And that was the fun part about watching it for me. Let's rewind a little bit now, because we've known each other about 15 years, give or take.
Give or take, yeah.
Did you, because I don't know if we've ever talked about it. We've talked about a lot of stuff, but is documentary filmmaking something that was always sort of on your agenda as like something you'd like to get into? How early did you start doing film work?
I'm an opportunist.
Yeah.
More than a, like, this is my dream and this is absolutely what I'm going to do. I think whatever opportunity presented itself to me and I was like, this seems like fun. I'm going to hop on this bandwagon. That was what I did. So as far as filmmaking goes, I majored in broadcasting for a while in college, but when I was a kid, I loved TV and movies and didn't know that that was a potential career. I mean, I lived in South Dakota.
Right.
You know, people were farming and, you know, the big dream was like to become a doctor or lawyer and make lots of money. Those seemed like, in my household at least, those were acceptable careers, not like movie making.
But you went to University of Nebraska.
Yeah.
And you majored in broadcasting and journalism. And
I majored in broadcasting so I could be on the college radio station. And then I dropped the major right before I graduated.
And graduated with?
Advertising journalism degree.
Great. They required you to be a broadcasting major just to do radio.
To do radio. Otherwise, you couldn't be on the radio.
And what was your radio show?
It was called Hot Lunch. And it was with Tony Bach.
Oh, yeah. And you guys co-hosted the show?
Yeah. And we had, the first year we had this guy on the show, and then we had a girl on the show. They had like a call-in show slot on Monday nights from 9 to 11. It's like the adult hour. And we did it for 2 years. And the show's name, Hot Lunch, was it came from a Daniel Tosh bit where he basically bombed at the Funny Bone in Omaha, talking about all these weird sexual terms. Hot Lunch was one of them. I don't remember exactly what it was,
yeah.
But it's something similar to a Cleveland steamer or something,
but
you know.
But in the mouth,
in
possibly
the mouth, yeah.
yeah. And so we met you through Tony, who I worked at CBS with, and then you had come to New York, and I think we were sort of friendly for a while, and I think the first thing we ever worked on together was the little TV sketch pilot, right?
No.
What did we do before that?
Friendster thing. With Doug Ray.
I don't even remember.
It was with that one girl was in the sketch.
Okay.
We shot it at my production company office.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't remember what the, it was for Miscellaneous or whatever show you were doing.
Oh, right.
At Galapagos.
Was that, was that the Donkey Punch? Wasn't there a Donkey Punch in that? Is that another sex
I think it was
move?
Maybe something with the Donkey Punch in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
But where she was mad at you for friending some other girl or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, right.
Oh, your status was single on
right.
Friendster?
Right.
Was the...
Yeah.
I mean, Friendster.
Right. Friendster. The original Facebook. Friendster predated MySpace even, yeah, I think.
That was the original social network.
Yeah.
Friendster.
We were ahead of our time doing Friendster sketches.
Yeah.
And then...
I had a stage microphone, like one of these, taped to a broomstick.
That was your boom? Your broom?
For a boom. Yeah.
And we've worked on a bunch of things together. I think that one of the nicest things anybody's ever said to me was your wife referring to our relationship as like a Scorsese DiCaprio.
Yeah.
She's like, you guys are like the poor version of Scorsese and DiCaprio. Just like, are going to work together if it kills you.
Yeah.
So we've done a lot of fun little projects. And then you actually shot and edited and did everything except for the stand-up comedy portion of Joe Prano Takes the Stand.
Yes, I did.
How was I know it was me, but like, how was it shooting a comedy special? Like, what was that? Was that enjoyable for you, or was that just like full favor project?
No, I think it was enjoyable. You know, my preference would have been to do it at a different venue with more ceiling height and more room to do some lighting,
yeah,
stuff like that. But it was, it was cool. And from my perspective, I was like, well, maybe at the time I was doing my own thing with my production company. I was like, this is not, it's not hard, mm-hmm, right? It doesn't take, shooting a live event is, as long as you hit record, it's a piece of cake.
And follow the subject.
Yeah. You know, it gets a lot more difficult when you've got a script or you're doing some sort of documentary thing. Live event stuff is easy. And I thought, you know, if this goes well, then I could pitch the same thing to other comedians that could scrape some money together or do a crowd fundraising thing to get their special done and release it themselves instead of trying to get a production company involved. So that's in addition to just...
Again, ahead of your time, you were Netflix before Netflix.
Yeah, wanting to do it for you, I was like, this could be a legitimate business thing. It's better than doing wedding videos for
right.
sure. And I could do it in one night, and it wouldn't take a ton of time.
And then, of course, my favorite part of the whole thing, we did the pre-roll,
yeah,
A Few Good Men shoot. Yeah.
That was great.
Which was great and went, you know, semi-viral in the promotion of it. Yeah. I think that's, you know, for you as a filmmaker, that's, you know, I know it was my project, but what I thought was so great about what you did is like you shot this really good short and then you shot a really good live event. And yeah. You're the same guy on both, and you did everything. And it's like, it's, you know, as far as a showcase of your work, that's a pretty good, I'm sure a lot of my listeners have seen it. So you are a narrative sort of filmmaker, and you're a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah.
And that's something you've dabbled in both over the years.
I'm a figure it outer.
Yeah.
You know, you just watch other stuff, and it's not, there's no mystery in how this stuff works. You know, what equipment someone else uses and then what lights and...
Because you have no formal film training.
No. I just have a good bullshit meter, you know? So I have a very keen ear from watching a ton of television and film for bad acting and stuff that's not... And I think that is the key to directing narrative is if I don't believe you, no one else is going to believe you. So if I'm like, that sounds made up or that sounds fake or this situation would never, ever happen or this is a totally unnatural way for two people to be conversing, don't sit like that, sit like this, you know, that is what I feel like 70 to 80% of directing is. And then the other 10% is finding a great location.
But there's a lot of technical aspects that go into both documentary and narrative filmmaking in terms of lighting it and coloring it and shooting it and all yeah. that. And I remember you, I forget if somebody was talking to you or you were just saying it generally, but the advice was don't spend money on film school, spend that money to make a film.
I mean, it was Dennis Leary that said that. Said save your money, just go out and yeah. make a movie. And that's exactly what, you know, going back to that Friendster thing, like that, on that, I learned something. On every single thing I've done, I've learned something that I have then put into action later. You know, the internet is an amazing resource and will teach you a lot of stuff, but there's still something that every one of those instructional filmmaking videos is leaving out. And you're not going to figure out what it is until you fuck up and make that mistake, and then you never do it again. So,
and do you normally realize your own mistakes in post, or do you often find mistakes when somebody else says, "Hey, you know, this is you're not supposed to do this, or you can't do that, or whatever"?
I have to learn it myself a lot of times. You know, just as because I'm stubborn and hard headed and think I know better. And sometimes even after I make mistakes, it takes me a while for me to admit that I did it.
Yeah.
Because I don't like being wrong. So, you know, just knowing when, like I told you to put the headphones on before we started listening to this because...
You've done it.
Just because the audio looks good on the levels doesn't mean it sounds good in the headphones. And I've made that mistake, and it really sucks to get a bunch of bad audio back. And there's nothing that takes a viewer out of something more, especially a listener. Even some podcasts that are done by very well-known people, their audio production is not even as good as yours on that will be on this. So it sucks.
And I remember when we did Joe Prano Takes the Stand, you said the biggest share of our crowdsourced funds will be going to sound because if the sound's bad, the whole thing's fucked.
Yeah,
and I've thought about that often, being like you got to have good sound. And now I've become sort of a sound snob. You know, if one guy's level's higher than the other, it's like, well, fuck, who am I tuning into here? Like. Yeah.
I can't listen a lot of times if there is, you know, a if someone's like live podcast, it's not as good. It's never going to be as good as when you're in a environment with controlled sound. And some people have fancy microphones in a bad room And like these stage mics are better in a bad room than a fancy microphone is, because a fancy one will pick up a bunch of shit that you don't
right
hear.
Just take the mic and put it.
Yeah, just next put it up to your mouth.
So obviously the process isn't over for Mole Man, right? You have there's still some work to do before it's locked and loaded, and you never have to think about it again.
Right.
What's left to take care of?
Well, I finished the film like 3 times, and it has to be finished again. Finished.
You need to.
Yeah. Just had to check that call got moved. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
We're good. We got another half hour.
Great. I have more stuff to talk to you about.
So, you know, when you make a movie, you finish editing it, but then there's another step in mixing the sound to make it all the same level. Also compress you kind of want to compress the highs and the lows a little bit, mix all the music so that sounds good. And then you want to color everything because, you know, sometimes you have your camera set to the wrong settings and you want to make A shot look like B shot. And mm-hmm. And there's also a certain spectrum for broadcast that you need to be within. So you need to color and mix your movie. And once that happens, you can't edit it anymore. So after the first time I finished it, when we did our first round of submissions for festivals, we went through that process. Didn't get into Sundance, Tribeca, or South By. So took a look, changed some stuff, and then had to finish it again. And now that we've got distribution, some of the music has to get pulled out, a couple little things have to change, so it's got to get finished again. And to go through that, you know, each time that happens, that takes money.
I feel like music is a huge part of documentary filmmaking mm-hmm. that goes along with it. And often, like I'm sure yours was, you have song choices. You're like, yeah, wouldn't it be great if this Rolling Stones song was in there?
Yeah.
But that's how difficult is that to find stuff that goes along with what you're doing, but is also, you know, relatively cheap and free to use?
I just use a huge music library, and I like to think I'm a pretty good music selector. If you had all the music in the world, I still don't think I would have made every single song like Rolling Stones or Beatles or something
right.
like that. I actually don't have any of that in the movie, but when you use a song like that, you want it to be at a poignant moment. You know, those songs mean things to people.
Yeah.
So if you're putting it under something that doesn't really match the tone.
This is where you aren't Scorsese, because
yeah.
he's always going to use the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
Every time.
Every time. But at the same time, in Scorsese movies, in narratives, you're not using as much as I used in a documentary.
Right.
So you remember he's using other music, you just don't remember it.
Yeah.
You know, there's score under some of that stuff, but you remember him using the Rolling Stones because it's at a moment when it's like emotional and you're...
Yeah.
Then you're making a connection with the song. So, I just use a big music library and took hours. And, I mean, I've spent so many days listening to music. It sucks to find music because there's so much bad music out there, especially in those libraries, that spend a lot of time going through it.
So you're going to finish the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's on deck?
I don't know.
You haven't even thought about it.
I have.
Is this the beginning of the next phase, or like are you a documentary guy now, or is this, I mean, you've said you're a bullshitter and you kind of go with the flow and you're whatever, but is this like,
I don't know, man. I would like to say I was going to make another documentary, but I don't know that I will. It's a ton of time. It's a ton of effort. If I do another one, it won't be at least the next one won't be the same style of like following a life as it's happening. I just with a kid and a job, you know, I was broke for a long time, kind of tired of that.
Yeah.
So, and with a job, I just can't pull off taking that kind of time to make something. It would be on a historical event that's already happened.
Right.
Is what I've said.
Everything you need's already there. You just got to find it.
You're just
putting
it together.
But
that may change. I don't know. Filmmaking is a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And something that, you know, you and I have been chasing for
a long time. It's the sweet and sour of the whole thing. And especially as a performer, is like the sweet part is just going and doing it. And like turning it over to a guy like you and saying, I know he made it look good. I know he's going to make it sound good. I know in the end it's going to be great. But then the sour is like, are we ever going to finish it? You know, how many things did we do that we didn't, you know, because it takes for fucking ever. And then how many things where you miss one thing? It seems like one line, one scene, whatever. And you're like, well, without that, we don't really have anything. So,
yeah, true. I mean, we still got that thing we shot in Brooklyn with Pete and Bardia.
Just call me Basil.
Yeah,
that's right.
Just sitting on my computer, it's like 60% done.
Yeah.
I got another script that I've written 80% of that just hasn't. I just haven't finished it.
Is filmmaking though and creating stuff, is it something that, because I in knowing you, I feel like I already know the answer to this, but is it something that you feel like you need to be doing every so often? Like do you feel like you need to output projects to go, hey, look, like I did it, or just for your own creative? I know you do 5 years of a documentary, you can kind of step back and say, I'm just going to do whatever. But do you get that itch to go like, oh, I need to shoot something?
I do get the itch. I'm feeling it less than I used to. I think it's just with getting older and having different priorities. And I don't know. Maybe this is probably a bad time for me to talk about it because I just finished doing an event.
Yeah.
And that was last night. And today I'm tired and I don't feel like doing anything.
Right.
So right now I'm like, I don't know if I'll ever make another movie. It's hard because it is a difficult industry to succeed in. And a lot of times, even when you do find some success, it's not enough. It's not sustainable. It's not like you're going to show up at the office every day and you know you're making a paycheck. You're always fighting for that next job. Maybe there's a point. I mean, I think there's a point where some people get to where the work is just coming to them always. But, you know.
But then.
I haven't hit that.
I mean, you seem like. Or
I hit that in television, right?
Yeah.
But I wasn't happy there. And it was sucking the life out of me. So I've been doing more advertising stuff now, which is better for now.
Using that major.
Yeah. Not even close.
Using that ad major you got.
Not even
You're
close.
You're like, I made that adjustment right at the end, just in case of this moment.
Nothing I learned in college prepared me for what I'm doing right now.
So I know you talked about your priorities changing because you have a son now.
Mm-hmm.
And how old's Gus?
He's going to be 2 in a week.
2 in a week?
Yeah.
And so.
He's 2.
Yeah. we'll put Gus's birthday on the map for everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
So that they can all tweet at you and tell Gus happy birthday.
Happy Gus.
And you're living up in Portland now.
Yeah.
But I feel like knowing you there, like you have an eye for this stuff and you certainly have talent with it. How about the sort of switch into this modern thing where everybody's, you don't post on social media that much. You're not like you're not taking fantastical Instagram shots around Portland all the time.
Yeah.
Are you sort of is that a conscious thing? Just like, I'm not into it and I don't need to share it. Because a guy, like with your talent, you would think, like I've seen pictures you take, you know, it's like you have an eye for this thing. Is it something that's just like you're shut off from it, like, and you don't really think about it much?
I am either 100% in or I just leave the switch off. If I have a camera with me and I see something, I'll do it, but I'm not out there always. Like, because it's annoying also, yeah. When people are always doing that.
Just sharing.
Yeah. And not just sharing, but just being with someone that is that type of sharer. They're always, you know, to like post great shots on Instagram every other day.
You have to stop everything that you're doing. Hold on, I got to get this. Look at this bridge.
Yeah, it becomes about your life, which if you're a photographer and that's what makes you happy, but it annoys my wife more than it makes me happy.
Right.
So.
And that makes you less happy.
That makes
an annoyed wife.
Yeah.
There's no amount of hearts on Instagram.
Exactly.
That can challenge an annoyed wife.
No.
Letterman. He has a quote that I reference a lot. There's no off position on the genius switch, but you're like, no, there is.
Yeah. Well, I think about it in different ways. You know, it's not because I'm not just a DP or I'm not just a photographer.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about different stuff.
Right.
It's always in the back of my mind, but I just don't feel the need to. I've never been a big bragger.
Yeah. Your work speaks for itself.
Well, I would like that to happen.
Yeah.
I would like that to happen. I think for me personally, that's the goal, is to have a reputation built on something that I didn't have to go out there and say like, hey, look at me, look at this, look at this, look at this.
Yeah.
So it's nice. I do it every once in a while and I, you know, likes feel good. But I also have a crippling fear of failure.
I mean, you spend 10 minutes annoying your wife getting that picture and no one likes it. Now the whole thing's been for naught.
But I think that's why a big part of the reason I haven't done more. And I think a lot of people probably feel the same way. But that's one of the hardest things to do, is put yourself out there. I mean, you get on stage and do comedy every night. And maybe it wears it down a little bit, but to work on something for a long period of time, put it out in the world, and have everyone else turn away feels like shit.
Yeah. Well, you know, the comedy, the sort of the way that I do comedy, the way that stand-up comics do it, it's sort of like the Mole Man, you know, or a documentary or a film, where it's first you're building it. And then the real, like, my job is the festival circuit. My job's like, hey, you guys, have you seen it? Hey, have you seen it? Hey, have you seen it? It's a little different than the last time you saw it. It's a little different. So it's like there's the process, which is sort of, obviously there's no one big thing. But, you know, people always talk about comics. Like, oh, you guys go out there and talk. It's like, I'm basically telling the same jokes every night, you know, that I've worked on over the course of however long. And now it's just, do you like me? Do you like me? Do you like me? Before we go, one thing I've always appreciated about you. Oh, wait, sorry, Siri.
Siri's got a question.
I should take Siri questions from Siri. That should be an aspect of the show. Siri, do you have any questions for Guy? You've always had, you know, a good ear for the music and things, and a good eye for stuff. What are things that you're watching, listening to, taking in now that may or may not inspire you to get back to work one day? Is there anything that anybody out there is like going like, oh, I saw that and then I was like, holy shit, I got to make a documentary or I got to make a film?
I mean,
sounds like you need a new Dave Matthews record in your life.
Yeah. Like I said, today is recovery day.
Yeah.
My relationship with music has changed a lot as I've gotten older. I used to be a seeker and go out there and look for the newest and greatest, but and said I would never change because I basically didn't want to get old.
Right.
But I think with the advent of podcasts and just the availability of basically talk radio that you can select what you listen to and you're not just pre-programmed into a few radio stations has really pulled me away from music to the point now where I'll listen to it, and newer albums I'll listen to. But for the most part, it's just kind of a daily mix on Spotify type of thing, where if I really hear a song I like, maybe I'll take a deeper dive into that artist. But there's so much music out there. It's not the same relationship I used to have where I find an album, listen to it, and it became life-changing. And maybe I'm just past those life-changing parts of my life, or those parts of your life where you're going to find an album and that's going to happen at a crucial shift. And it becomes a soundtrack to an emotion you had. So as far as music goes, I still enjoy it, but
I think there's also something to like just the physicality of, we weren't vinyl. We're not old enough that like the vinyl is like a big part of our life, but even like tapes and CDs, like it's easy to hit play again and start a CD over. It's slightly harder to take it out, put it back in your case if you're the kind of person that cares to take care of a CD, get another one, take it out, put it in. It's like, I feel like it was much easier to say, repeat. Like, that's easy. We're in the middle of something. Do that again. Like you said, now with digital music, it's like artists. Okay, it's going to roll. It's going to be Kanye, and it's going to roll into the other guy that Kanye just worked with, and then it's going to roll into this person, and next thing you know, you're in the same realm, but you're pretty far off from where you started on a Spotify radio or a Apple Music radio.
Yeah.
And I feel the exact same way. And then there's just so many options too. Why aren't we just all shuffling all the time? You know.
I don't know. I think that's what I am doing, shuffling all the time, and hitting the heart button every once in a while. From a film perspective, I love the first season of Westworld.
Yeah.
And the second one, some of the characters, I just don't care about the stories, but the overall, like mixing sci-fi and Western, those are my two favorite genres. So I'm in.
Right.
I
thought season one was fantastic. And then my body physically was not into, I cannot watch season two without falling asleep.
Yeah.
It's like it's become like golf for me. I'm like, I know I'm supposed to love it. It looks really good. This moment's interesting. And then, like you said, you get to a character that I half care about, and like I literally fall asleep.
Yeah.
It's hard.
So a lot of the documentary stuff that's been happening on Netflix, I just watched Evil Genius, the Wild Wild Country thing.
Yeah.
It's just about finding that story. Like, I have no doubt that I could make any of those. So it's just about locking into a story that
I'll start a sex cult for you.
Yeah. And then there we go.
And then 10 years from now, we'll be like, I got it, buddy.
Make it happen.
I've been filming it on my iPhone the whole time.
There was just that one that happened in New York with like some actresses that were baiting people into doing it. Whatever. But, and then from a narrative standpoint, I would love to do some comedy. I don't know that there's anything out there that like that's that great right now.
Yeah.
But I think anything that is in the vein of sort of the Jody Hill, Danny McBride, that world, I don't know what you'd even call it, but just that type of character and that tone. I like all that stuff. So.
Yeah.
I really suck when it comes to naming specific.
No, well, the reason I asked is because I've often been where I am right now, which is like, I just don't like, is everything garbage?
Yeah.
And then a lot of times I'd come to you and you'd be like, oh, you got to check out this. You got to check out this. You got to check out this. You've sent me on a path. And then like a Spotify playlist that leads to something else, leads to something else. So I always like to ask my more creative friends whose opinions I trust, like, hey, put me on to something.
Yeah.
And now I'm asking for whoever's listening for you to do the same thing. So you got a couple good ones.
I like the new Unknown Mortal Orchestra album. It's pretty good.
There you go.
And, it's no secret, but the new Kid Cudi's pretty good.
Yeah,
I think. You want to talk about the new Kanye album?
Yeah, let's do it. Are you allowed? I know you're doing a lot of work with Adidas. Are you allowed to give Kanye West album opinions?
Yeah, totally. I don't think it's a great production.
Yeah,
I don't think it's even the greatest. By far the greatest music that he's done. But what I do appreciate is it's him.
Yeah, you
know? It's raw. Like I believe it's that guy. That it's pretty pure, and that I think is what I respect more than anything else is just getting a clear perspective from an artist, from a filmmaker. If someone's trying to make something like everyone else, it's not going to be any different. You know, you can't make a copy of a copy of a copy and expect to move the needle. When I was making Mole Man, people told me to, like, you should watch Marwin Call. This really reminds me of that story. And I was like, well, I'm not going to watch Marwin Call because that's already a movie. And even though it has some similarities, I don't want to get... Because once you see something...
Whether you like it or not.
It's baked in your brain.
Yeah.
And then you're going to make decisions based on how this was here, or how that was there. So that's what I like about the Kanye record is that it's not, you know, he was just... vomiting that out in a couple days.
I agree with you because I listen to it and it's like we've gone, especially with hip hop. I mean, we had we're sort of old enough where the earliest days of hip hop, we were kids for it and we was around and it was all this like, oh, like hip hop's just about like being in hip hop. And then hip hop was like, oh, fuck the police. And then hip hop was like money, cars, women. And then hip hop was like, you know, beefs, and like there, it seems like there's always something going on. And now it's like in the past few years, it's like, you know, brand checking everything. Everything's, I use this and I use this and I use this. And Kanye's thing's like, I'm fucked up. And I'm like, yeah, cool. Yeah. Like I'm fucked up too. Not like you're fucked up, yeah. But it's cool to just hear you rap about your fucked upness.
Yeah, and there is an element of that. It's like the car accident thing. Like everyone likes to look at a car accident because it's not them. Like, oh, that's bad. I'm glad it's not me.
Yeah.
And with Kanye's record, it's like, God damn, that guy's
got some
issues.
I put the three
stars. They're not all just like us.
Yeah,
some of them are much much worse.
I put the three. I put the Pusha T, the Kid C Ghost, and the Kanye into one playlist, and I tried to order it myself. And make one whole 20 song thing. Mm-hmm. But I had to remove his poem about just murdering people. I was just like, that's out. Just doesn't have enough of a beat for me. It's going to kill the whole vibe.
Yeah.
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
It's out.
But that really does set the tone for the record.
Yeah.
You know, and I understand why he put it where he did. Or at least I think I do. I have no idea.
Well, Guy, thank you for carving out some time.
Oh, one more question. What do you think of Childish Gambino and that? What was that song called?
This and the Jay Farrow.
This, like, is America.
Yeah. Oh, the song or
the song, the video.
So there's new news. I don't know how busy you've been, but yesterday, 2 days ago, there's a song that is already out that has America in the title that Jay Farrow rapped on. That is like almost the same exact song. And it's been out for a couple years. So now there's the, you know, did he subconsciously steal it, consciously steal it?
I have not heard this but when I heard that song, I was like, this is not just I heard before I even saw the video. I just heard the music and didn't feel it was original. I felt like it was basically everything else that's kind of going on. It was a little mumble rap. Or whatever they call that. I shouldn't be talking about hip hop.
Yeah. You don't have your Yeezys on today. Otherwise, you'd be as qualified as anybody to talk. Are they?
Yeah.
See, I don't even know what Yeezys look like anymore.
But yeah, his music is not extremely original. And he's someone like that song Redbone.
Yeah.
Definitely takes a lot of influences. I don't know.
Yeah, I
would appreciate it, but the fact that everyone was bending over backwards saying how brave and original it was, just makes me like it a little bit less.
Yeah, no, I agree. I've sort of always been that way with him. I'm just like, my other thing is, first things first with hip hop, I drive a 1979 Cadillac that doesn't have air conditioning. Can I roll down the street with my windows open, having the song at a volume that I like to listen to music, and not be sort of embarrassed or feel judged or whatever? And like, when hip hop kind of bangs, I'm like, I'm in. I don't care if it's, you know, if you're talking about mental illness. I don't care if you're talking about, you know, torture. I don't care if, you know, like, I'll go Wu-Tang Method Man, like, down the street and be like, oh, I'm so your asshole close. I'm like, great. Just don't make it like weird. Like, just if it just seems unoriginal and weird and like too anything, I'm just like, I'm out.
Yeah.
That's the first standard for hip hop. What I listen to at home is one thing, and then like, but you only get into the Cadillac. If you're in the Cadillac level, that's how I'm like, you get the real stamp of approval.
Yeah.
So Kanye's new one made it.
Oh, yeah?
Kanye's making it. I like it.
Kids Childish Ghost. Gambino, not
I don't think not any of it ever, really.
Yeah.
It's never made the Cadillac list. So I guess that's that.
Yeah.
That's my standard.
I like it.
Well, guy, thanks for sitting down. You're not much of a social media guy. Do you want anybody to follow you, or to where do you want people to go? How do they?
I mean, I got Instagram. Sure.
Yeah.
So when I post every 2 months, you can.
You're G Fiorita.
Throw me a like. I'm Guy Fiorita on Instagram.
Okay.
And then Twitter is Ego Maintenance, not Guy Fiorita, because that's my third cousin.
And Mole Man.
Mole Man.
Comes out streaming services.
Yeah, it's on. There's a Facebook page for Mole Man. I still got to get that web presence bumped up for that.
Yeah, and will there be more? Will there be more festival screenings before it goes streaming?
If you're in Rotterdam, Netherlands,
are you going?
No, I'm not going. I asked.
So don't go for the Q&A.
They said they'd get me a hotel, but I have to pay my own way there.
And I'm out.
No thanks. But yeah, that's sometime in October. But otherwise, there may be one in Portland, Oregon, coming up. And that's probably October too. But other than that, I've done, you know, it's been in 7 or 8 festivals. So it's got a distribution deal.
Right.
It's just money out of my pocket to go to festivals at this point.
So find it on Facebook, follow Guy and everything. I will, you guys are following me, so I'll obviously be sharing stuff when it happens, and, see Joe Prano Takes a Stand if you haven't already, and you can see some of Guy's work that is available on the internet.
For sure.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.